At one point, I was ashamed of being an addict. I didn't want to admit it, but now I'm grateful that I've experienced this battle with addiction because I've grown so much through it. You know, I've learned how to, you know, cope with life on life's terms and my anger issues, my trauma, and communication with people. So I feel like after this treatment process and the recovery process, I can be a more productive member of society. I can go to college and get more out of that experience because I've experienced this previously.
You're listening to Real Recovery Talk with your host, Tom Conrad. Every day, Tom helps guide people like you who have loved ones dealing with addiction. You're most likely frustrated with the situation, worried your loved one won't get better, and concerned you're not doing enough to help. This show will help you understand the tremendous struggle of addiction from your loved one's perspective. You'll hear stories of recovery, which will give you hope. And you'll understand the limits to what you can and can't do to help those you love. Tom is a certified addictions counselor who's successfully winning his own battle with drug addiction and alcoholism and has helped many others win theirs as well. It's time now for Real Recovery Talk.
Here we are, Real Recovery Talk. I am your host, Tom Conrad. In today's episode, it is just me. We don't have any Benjamin B. with us today, reluctantly. He had some stuff that he had to tend to. So it's just myself, and we have a guest on today's show. And today's guest, his name is Jeremy, and he's going to talk a lot about his story and his addiction. And it's really interesting. I've had the opportunity to know Jeremy now for a couple of months and gotten to know a lot about him and his story. And I think it's very relative to a lot of people. And one of the things in particular is Jeremy is retired, medically retired from the Army. And he has a hell of a story, and I know it's going to resonate with so many people. So we'll get into that. But first things first, go to realrecoverytalk.com. There you will find every single episode that we have ever recorded. I believe this is going to be episode 156. So you have 155 episodes that you get to choose from. Just scan the topics, scan and read the descriptions of the episodes, and find what resonates with you or your loved one. Take a listen. And in the end, if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can always reach out to myself or Ben. Our emails are Tom@realrecoverytalk.com and Ben@realrecoverytalk.com. Just send us an email with your question or whatever, but nine times out of 10, what we do is ask for phone numbers, and we're going to want to have some sort of phone conversation with you, and we can guide you through whatever it is that you or your loved one is going through. So realrecoverytalk.com or any of your favorite podcast playing apps, and that is it. So here we go. Jeremy is with us today. Jeremy is decided that he wants to come on and share his story in hopes that somebody hears it and can get the hope that they might need to take this whole journey of sobriety. Again, like I just said, Jeremy has a hell of a story. I don't want to spoil it. We're just going to get right into it. Jeremy, appreciate you coming on. First things first is just give us a little synopsis about you, how old you are, where you're from, you know, and then we'll kind of get into like your childhood stuff and really peel the layers of the onion back to find out more about you, and in hopes the listeners can hear and understand your story and get hope from that. So let's start there. How old are you? Where you're from? And let's get into your childhood a little bit.
Hi, I'm Jeremy. I'm 39 years old. I'm from Concord, North Carolina. I'm retired from the Army, medically retired, due to some PTSD and some combat injuries. And this is my eighth time in treatment, fifth time this year.
So when you say you are medically retired, how long were you in the Army for?
9 years.
You were in for 9 years.
Yes.
And at what age did you enlist into the Army?
23.
23 years old?
Yes.
Okay. So you've been out of the Army now for about how long?
It's been 5 years.
5 years. Okay. So let's go into your childhood. How was it? Like, were your parents separated? Did you grow up with any siblings? Stuff like that?
My parents have been together all of my life until this year. So I come from a very good family. You know, North Carolina, brought up with manners and to have respect. And I grew up with two siblings, an older brother and a younger sister.
An older brother and a younger sister. Did either of them go the military route or no?
No, just me.
Is the military something that was in your family or?
Yes. My grandfather was a Marine and I have two uncles that joined the Navy.
Okay, cool. And I'm excited for this episode because I don't think, at least from my recollection, I've never actually interviewed a veteran, in particular, one that's suffering with addiction. And it's no secret that a lot of veterans suffer from PTSD, and that is something that obviously you have gone through and are continuing to go through. And so I think it's interesting, and I'm excited to you know, get to understand more about you and where maybe a lot of this PTSD came from. So let's stay in your childhood. When did, like, what was it like for you growing up with your parents, and were you involved in sports? Did you have like a group of friends that you hung out with? And like, when did you really identify as somebody that enjoyed drinking and using drugs? And like, at what age was that around?
So my childhood was really great, you know, involved in baseball, football, and racing dirt bikes mainly. You know, I had several friends growing up. You know, most of them weren't from as good of families as mine, but my parents would always kind of take them in like they were, you know, brothers of mine. So, yeah, my childhood was great, except for there was one incident. There was some childhood trauma from a distant family member, a member of the church. You know, I was sexually molested at age 5, and I feel like I never really dealt with it or understood what actually happened to me until I reached puberty. And then all the thoughts and the guilt and the lack of understanding just all flooded in at one time. And that's when I started reaching for substances. You know, it started out with doctors prescribing me benzodiazepines for insomnia and anxiety, along with antidepressants. And, you know, it progressed from there. I just started numbing myself out. And even at that young of age, I would abuse those benzos.
So staying there for a second, you were how old again? 14?
14.
And you obviously didn't have the full understanding of, I mean, a doctor prescribes this. So most people have the mentality of, well, a doctor is prescribing this. It's obviously something that I need.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I actually feel like I learned that behavior from that experience to reach for a substance for comfort. And that's what I continued to do throughout the years.
And what do you think from your parents' perspective, if they were on this podcast right now and they were talking, what do you think they would say about you being prescribed benzos at 14 or 15 years old? Were they probably in the same camp of not really understanding?
Yeah, I believe that they were there too, as far as the not understanding or the, you know, trusting the doctors. They did the best they could with me. You know, I was struggling and they recognized that, and, you know, they sent me to a doctor, you know, so that it is what it is.
You shared, before recording, an example of how the anxiety and the social anxiety affected you. Do you care to go into that a little bit about like when you were going into the stores?
Sure. You know, I would be like in Walmart or in the mall with my mother or someone, and I would just feel the need to just get out of there as quick as I could. It was just major social anxiety that would hit me And I just didn't feel comfortable. And sometimes I just didn't feel comfortable in my own skin.
And so you would leave the stores, and where did you find comfort? Like, what made you comfortable once you jetted out of the store?
I think it was just the getting away from people, because I developed this lack of trust in people. Once I came to the realization that what happened to me as a child was a trusted member of my church, a trusted person in my family. And, you know, I just stopped trusting people. I didn't feel comfortable around people unless it was my intermediate family.
And about how long do you feel like that had that affected you?
You know, it's affected me all of my life in some way, shape, or form. I've recently done some EMDR to work through that, and it's helped out a lot. I've done some neurotherapy to help with my anxiety, and just done a lot of self introspection in the last year, where I'm finally coming to terms with, you know, what happened, and I only have control of the here and now. So, yeah.
How does that make you feel now, knowing that, I mean, what you just said, really, the past is the past, you know, like, do you have a different perspective on it now today than you did in the past?
I don't know about a different perspective, but I'm not angry anymore. I suffered from anger for a long time with this. I wanted revenge, you know. I wanted to know why my life was the way it is. And, you know, I struggled with that. I always felt less than for it. But now that I'm overcoming it, you know, I feel like it's making me a stronger person.
Okay, cool. And I'm glad that we got to hone in on that a little bit, because, you know, a lot of times when people get sober, you hear a lot that addiction a lot of times is rooted in childhood traumas, you know, a lot of different things that is rooted in childhood. It could be abandonment issues, some sort of traumatic event happens. But a lot of times when people get clean and sober, they tend to not really buy into that, because it's, you know, how could something that happened to me at 5 years old play an effect on me today at 39 years old, you know, when I'm still trying to get sober? And I think this is a good example of, for you, doing the work and doing and going through the therapeutic process and starting to understand how this has played an effect on me, and being willing and open-minded to take a look at that and to work through that. And I think freedom comes on the other side of that. Would you agree?
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't like to use my trauma, either from childhood or the military, as an excuse for my addiction. I believe that there are many factors that play a part in being an addict. Part of it that I recognize is genetic as well, with my father being an alcoholic, his father being an alcoholic. So all I know now is that despite what happened to me, despite all the trauma, it is my responsibility now to do the right thing in order to recover from addiction. And I think that's the important part that I have to stay focused on.
Yeah, that's a good thing to recognize. So going back, when did you start to find your identity in drugs and alcohol?
About 15, 16 years old, you know, I started drinking with a girlfriend, started drinking with my friends. You know, the normal childhood thing to do these days is, you know, pretty much what it was. Going into 16 and 17, started going to a lot of keg parties with, I hung out with like older guys, a couple years older than me, you know. So by the time I'm in ninth grade, you know, I'm hanging out with seniors, juniors and seniors from high school. Some of them were bringing cocaine to the keg parties. You know, I experimented with that, didn't really get hooked on it, you know, enjoyed it, but never went looking for it. If it was there, I did it. If not, I didn't. But, then OxyContin was introduced to me at around 18 years old. And, so that's when I started really facing my addiction. And it started out with the chemical dependency aspect of it. You know, once I did OxyContins for a week or 2 weeks, because I really enjoyed the way it took away my social awkwardness. It made me feel more comfortable around people. I continued doing it, but then when I ran out, I realized that I was going to be really sick from it, and then I would need to continue doing it. And then that's when I started, you know, really going down a bad road. You know, I'm a pretty honest person. You know, I don't really steal from people, but I would steal to get my fix at that point, because it was either that or be sick, not be able to go to work. Everyone's wondering what's going on with me, feel majorly depressed. And I just felt like I was shackled at that point to a substance that I needed to live.
How were you introduced to OxyContin to begin with?
Just a friend, pretty much. I had done other pain pills before. You know, I had a friend from high school that worked at a pharmacy, and she would steal pills by the thousands. But it wasn't till OxyContin came out that a friend said, "Hey, chop this up, snort this, you know, tell me how you feel." And it was, you know, it was perfect. It was love. You know, I found what I needed.
And so you graduated high school. Did you graduate high school?
I actually got kicked out in the 10th grade for assault on a government official. And I went on to get my GED a few years later.
Okay. And so the reason I ask is because you joined the military at 23. So what took place from like 18 to 23 years old?
Well, it was on again, off again addiction with OxyContin and other opiates until I finally went to the methadone clinic for about a year. Got tired of, you know, being shackled to that substance and having to go there every day just to get my dose, and decided I wanted to do something different with my life. My first niece was born. You know, I wanted to be a good role model, and that was just like another motivator to make me actually take a step back and take a look at my life and really do some soul searching and figure out what I wanted to do. And I was able to get clean on my own at that point. After, you know, 2 years of sobriety from methadone and opiates, you know, it's when I started talking to an Army recruiter. You know, I always loved everything about the military. I knew that that's what I wanted to do once I got sober. And that's what I did. I went for it.
So let's take just a minute, and I want to talk about your methadone and the reason. And I didn't know that we were going to go in this direction, but Ben and I are very passionate about abstinence-based treatment, you know, and we have very strong opinions when it comes to medically assisted treatment, meaning methadone, Suboxone, Subutex, stuff like that. What was your experience exactly when you were on the methadone?
I still wasn't able to really live my life fully. I still felt very spiritually broken. Like there was just a disconnect there. Like I wasn't able to, I reached a plateau, and all I was able to do is go to work and come home and sleep and eat. And it was just like I was almost like a mindless robot, just going through the motions constantly. And it was really depressing to me because I wanted so much more out of life.
So you felt like you were kind of still in the grips of addiction, just off of, you were addicted to methadone.
Most definitely. Because, you know, without me going to the methadone clinic every morning or every few days a week, I knew I would be sick. I knew that I had to have that substance. And, you know, like I said, I was shackled to that at that point, and I wanted to be free from everything.
Yeah, I think that's important, because a lot of times, and, you know, it's unfortunate that Suboxone and methadone, they're a lot of time, don't get me wrong, I feel like they work for some people. And I would argue that that's a very small population of people. I think my opinion is that stuff needs to be given to somebody that literally you're just trying to keep them alive, you know, at that point. But it sounds to me you were, I'm led to believe, 19 or 20 years old when you were on methadone. Was that?
That's correct.
And so you get on the methadone to come off of the OxyContin, but yet you just, it's just, you know, switching addictions from one to the other. There still wasn't any, like you just said, spiritual growth. There wasn't any growth as a human being, really. I mean, because you had to spend all your waking time going to work, sleeping, and going and getting your dose.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, just very much still numbing out to everything in life. I think all of those feelings were completely necessary for me to feel in order to grow. And being on a substance like methadone or Suboxone, I just wasn't experiencing any growth. And I just remained stagnant. And, you know, I agree that the maintenance programs can help some people. And I would rather see someone on a maintenance program if they're definitely going to go out and shoot fentanyl or heroin, because maybe that'll save their life, but it's only a temporary fix, in my opinion. I think at some point, those people should start the recovery process and practice abstinence from drugs and alcohol altogether.
So you said you had 2 years clean off of methadone. Is that so, like 21 to 23 when you entered into the military?
Yes.
And what were you doing for that? How did you get that 2 years clean? Like, how did that look?
I guess you would call it white knuckling it. I just started focusing on work and working out at the gym and going to church. I did develop a spiritual connection there, going to church, and a connection with people, members of the church. I had a good girlfriend at the time who wasn't into drugs, so that was another motivator for me. And like I said, with my niece being born, you know, I wanted more out of life, and that was enough for me at that point, to find a purpose in life, to keep me sober, but it didn't last.
So what I hear from you in that is, and this I think rules true for so many people, when we're in the grips of addiction and we really want to get out from the grips, I think it's part of our nature to look, and I say this all the time, we look for external solutions for an internal problem. You know, and what I hear from you is in that 2 years time, you know, you focused on work, you focused on your girlfriend, you focused on all of these different things that really would, you know, filled the time, you know, served a okay purpose, but there's still that internal struggle that wasn't being addressed whatsoever. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I was focusing on all the external, you know, and like I said, that wasn't enough to suffice in the long run as far as my sobriety and recovery from addiction goes. It was a short term fix.
So take us now into you enlist into the military. What's your mindset going into this? You're clean and sober, right?
Yes. So enlisting in the military, you know, I really didn't know what to expect. It was all new to me, but, you know, I needed that excitement in my life. I needed that adventure, but I think it was just another way to fill that internal void that was missing in me. And it worked for a long time because, anything that I do, I try to do the best I can at it. You know, I want to be the best, and I was a great soldier for a long time. You know, I experienced some, combat injuries, some combat trauma, watched some buddies die, and, with my injuries and going through some survivor's guilt, and all of that just kind of hit me at once, and I got very depressed, and I started taking the pain pills the doctor prescribed me, thinking I could handle it. So 7 years in is when that stuff started, and you know, I went downhill fast then. It was back to taking too much of my prescription, buying prescriptions off of other soldiers that were injured, searching for, you know, other means to numb myself in alcohol or pretty much any drugs I could find when I was stationed in Germany.
So you had the 2 years clean before enlisting, and then you said it took 7 years. So did you have roughly about 9 years substance free?
Yes, that's correct.
Wow. And that, so that whole time, like the 7 years while you're in the military, I mean, it's just go, go, go. I assume you had deployments and, you know, what was it like? And I'm only asking, I've never been in the military. I'm curious, what was your mindset like? I mean, especially having such a, you know, an addictive lifestyle prior to the military, what was it about the military that really let you not focus on that or run back to that for the 7 years that you did?
I feel like just having a purpose in life and being part of something that's bigger than myself helped out a lot. You know, I had a lot of respect for the guys I served with, a lot of respect for my command, and I was proud of what I was doing for once in my life. I felt like I had arrived, that was what I was going to do the rest of my life. And, you know, it helped keep me sober. And when I say sober, I don't mean that I didn't drink alcohol on the weekends with my buddies, because I did. But when I say sober, I wasn't using opiates, smoking weed, and totally numbing out for that 7 years.
So you'd go on the weekends to wherever, have some beers with the guys and stuff like that. But it wasn't like it was, you know, addicted to opiates.
That's correct. You know, I was always able to just drink for a night or two and, you know, be done with it. I knew that I had to be back on duty and that I had responsibilities. I had soldiers to look after. So, you know, all of those things were motivating factors for me to stay in check.
What advice would you give to somebody that, say, is struggling with addiction? And I had this conversation with somebody last week. And it's interesting that we're talking about this, because this individual, it was over the phone. They're obviously struggling with a lot of the same issues that you were struggling with. And that person verbatim said, I'm going to join the Army Reserves because I feel like that's something that can really help me overcome this. What advice would you have for somebody that is thinking that? Is it right or is it wrong? I don't know.
I don't know that I can say it's right or wrong. I think it's a great thing either way, but I think it's only going to last if the internal, the spiritual malady is repaired. If that person does work on themselves spiritually and doesn't just put all their eggs in that one basket and expect that to keep them sober, because you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, you could get injured or you could face traumas, or maybe you just don't work out there and then you're left with back to yourself. You know, all these things are external. So all we have in the long run is ourselves. So I would advise that person to focus on the spirituality aspect of things and a healthy balance of mind, body, and spirit
before taking that plunge into the military.
Yes.
Because I mean, just from what I've seen from others and heard from others, when you enlist or whatever, you go through boot camp. I think it's pretty well known that it's designed to break you down.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely designed to break you down and build you back up in the way that they can use you the best to their advantage. So I'm not really sure they're concerned with all of those things. They just have a use for you, and that's what you're going to be doing. So,
which, and I have the utmost respect for people in the military, you know, and every opportunity I have, I thank them for their service just the same as I do you, you know. And but I do think that I agree 100%, like you have to be ready to take that, you know. And this particular individual, my recommendation for them was, hey, listen, from what I think, and from what I've seen, in my opinion, is the military isn't going to fix your addiction. And I use that analogy. You're looking for an external solution for an internal problem. Let's figure out the inside before and get you squared away there before you go enlist into the army. That way, when you do go into the army, you're prepared to get broken down. You're prepared to be under, drill sergeants and stuff like that, that, you know, like you just said, it's really their job to break you down and build you back up and form you into this person that can be useful to protect our country, protect your fellow soldiers, so on and so forth. And that I think causes a lot of stress for people. And a lot of times people handle their stress through drugs and alcohol. And the military is a very stressful situation, at least from what I understand. I mean, I don't see how it can be anything different. So 7 years, you did okay. And then you got year 8 and year 9, things kind of went south.
That's correct. I wasn't able to fully handle the trauma and the injuries and, the pain meds that were prescribed to me at the time of my injuries. And, I feel like I went into the military deciding, you know what, if I die doing this, that is so much better than what I've done with my life so far. And I made peace with that. So when it didn't work out that way, I was left back to my own devices. So I think the working on the inside is great advice for anyone trying to join the military. The military might not always be there for you, you know, and there are drugs and alcohol in the military too, lots of them. You know, we go to other countries all the time. There's all types of influences around. A lot of the soldiers glamorize the use of alcohol. So I think being prepared for that and to face that and whatever happens to you is an important piece that someone needs to work on.
Let me ask you this again. It's for my own curiosity. Say I'm in the Army or I'm in the Marine Corps, whatever, and I have this problem. I know it's a problem. You know, say I'm drinking every day, you know, and I'm waking up and I'm having the shakes and I'm, you know, and I approach my whoever is above me, my officer or whatever, and tell them what's going on. How is that generally received?
Well, they will try to get you help. There's an Army substance abuse program, and I'm sure the other branches of service have a similar program. But when you start going to appointments that when you're not on duty, you stop being as dependable as a soldier, your platoon sergeant's going to be aware of it. You know, you're going to be looked at as weak, to be honest with you, because not everyone understands addiction. Some of these people can just go drink and they're fine. And then some people can't, you know, it takes them down a really bad road. And then I just feel like there's a stigma around addiction, alcoholism, whether in the military or not. And definitely in the military, you're going to be viewed as weak.
It's unfortunate, I mean, but I can totally understand and see why that would be, you know, and I mean, really, you're there to perform a duty. And just the same as like, you know, somebody's supposed to go, you know, works for the post office or supposed to perform, you're supposed to deliver mail, and you can't do that because of your substance abuse issues. And I think there is a stigma. You hit the nail on the head. A lot of times people look at drug addicts and alcoholics and say, why can't you just stop? I mean, your job, your career, your financial stability is weighs in the balance of your substance abuse. Why wouldn't you be able to just stop? And I think it's an unfortunate thing, because you and I both living through this, obviously circumstances are different, but it's not something you can just stop. If it was that easy, I wouldn't have to approach you in the first place and tell you, you know, it's not like I'm cheerful and joyful about coming to you and saying, hey, I got this issue that I can't stop. It's not that easy. If it were, everybody would be doing it.
Right. You know, it's unfortunate that no one really understands, you know, from an addict's perspective, what we're dealing with, you know, family, friends, superiors at work, in the military, or anywhere in life. But, you know, we just have to accept that's the way it is now. It's, I don't know that they're ever going to understand it because they don't deal with it. And so how would they know? So I don't really, you know, blame them, but it would be nice if there were more, there was more awareness that this is a disease of the thoughts of the mind. And that, that we need treatment just like a cancer patient would need treatment for cancer.
Yeah. I think if that tide ever turns, you know, it's going to be a very, you know, cause look, drug addicts and alcoholics, I mean, they're everywhere, you know, lawyers, you know, doctors, military, you know, garbage men, it affects everybody, you know, and I really do feel like, especially people that have gone through what we have gone through, if we can get to that other side, we're so much more productive than, say, your quote unquote normie. You know, because we've grown and gone through so much in our addiction, and you get to the other side of that and you start to feel the hope and the freedom. And like it says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we now have a new lease on life, you know, and we have a different perspective and a different outlook. And I firmly believe that we're more productive. We're more reliable. We're more dependable than, say, somebody that's never gone through what we've gone through. What's your thoughts on that?
I completely agree with you. And I've been experiencing that this year. You know, this is my fifth time in treatment this year. And I'm grateful for the year 2020. I've experienced more growth this year in this recovery process than ever before in my life. I've learned more about myself. You know, I've had to be resilient and continue bouncing back and just persevere through this thing in order to reach this point in my recovery. You know, when I started this treatment process, you know, I realized that these treatment programs aren't necessarily just about recovering from drugs and alcohol, but I learned so much about my life. I even said that, you know, my mother and sister aren't addicts, but they would benefit from going through these programs and this process that we go through. You know, I'm grateful for. At one point, I was ashamed of being an addict. I didn't want to admit it, but now I'm grateful that I've experienced this battle with addiction because I've grown so much through it. You know, I've learned how to, you know, cope with life on life's terms and my anger issues, my trauma, and communication with people. So I feel like after this treatment process and the recovery process, I can be a more productive member of society. I can go to college and get more out of that experience because I've experienced this previously.
Yeah. So given the five treatment attempts that you've gone through this year, what has been why has it taken five attempts? Not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing, but what do you think it is? Like, what have you been missing that has caused you to relapse and then go back into treatment and then back into treatment? Like, do you know that answer or no?
I'm still in the process right now of figuring all of this out, but I want to say that, you know, some people have to experience a great deal of pain with the substance use. Like, I'm to the point now that when I think about using, I've experienced so much pain with it that I've attached those thoughts of pain with my thoughts of using. Whereas in the past, it was more of a romanticizing the use of drugs and alcohol. And I don't remember that part anymore. So that's a big piece of it. Really just being tired of starting over. You know, I've lost so much in my addiction that it's just not worth it to me anymore. And I've grown spiritually. I've got to know myself, and it's been a long process. But you know, dealing with anger issues and rejection and resentments always used to take me back out to using, and I'm learning how to cope with those things. And you know, for those people that can go through treatment once and get it and remain sober, that's great. But that wasn't my experience. You know, some of us just have to go through a longer process of healing than others, I believe.
So what do you, from your perspective, what do you feel are some of the biggest contributing factors for your sobriety today and moving forward? Like, if you were to say, okay, I need X, Y, and Z to remain sober from this point moving forward, what would you feel like those would be?
Most importantly, I have to place myself around sober people that want the same things out of life that I want. You know, if I hang out with kids that live in their mother's basement, that's pretty much where I'm going to end up to. So, having a strong sober support system, people that I can connect with that are remaining sober, that are serious about being sober, is very important to me. You know, I pretty much have to focus on my spirituality and my connection with my higher power, and always, you know, cultivate the awareness that things could go really bad, that if I want to, I can really screw my life up again. And I have to remain cognizant of that at all times.
The community aspect of sobriety, I think, is very important, that a lot of times people take advantage of or don't take advantage of. And I say it all the time, you show me your friends, I'll show you your future, you know, and it's just the same for, you know, it's going to go one of two ways. You're either going to surround yourself with people that want to do this, that are being productive in sobriety, that are, you know, striving to continue to make growth, or you're going to surround yourself with people that are just going to be stagnant. And you hit the nail on the head. If you hang out with people that live in their mother's basement, you're going to be shacking up in your mom's basement before long. And I think that's a good takeaway for, you know, those of you listening, that you're a product of your environment. You know, there's the saying, you're the average of the sum of the five people you surround yourself with. Take my top five friends that I hold dearest to me, and I'm going to be the average of them, you know? And I think that's very important. And that's something that a lot of people miss in this sobriety thing. You know, they try and just do it on their own, or, you know, hanging out with these people because they're doing the cool, you know, whatever it is, but not really making much progress. And then fast forward a year, 2 years or whatever, and they're, yeah, you might be clean, but you're not making any life advances, you know?
Right. I completely agree with that. You know, there are people in this program that aren't ready to cut off their old friends, and that's going to be a big problem for recovery. You know, for me, I have to change everything about myself, my attitude, my environment. I have to tap into the many facets in life that are going to fill my clock throughout the day with positive things to connect me with nature, to connect me with my higher power, connect me with a good community of sober support people. Those things are detrimental to recovery, in my opinion.
So, moving forward, where do you see yourself? Like, what do you want to do? I mean, you're 39, you know, you're retired from the military, you're clean, you're sober, you don't have any kids, not married. Like, what's your future? What do you want to do?
Well, I feel like there's no higher calling than helping other people. And with the experience that I have in this recovery process with PTSD, with childhood trauma, I feel like I have a lot to offer to addicts and alcoholics. I would really like to work with veterans. So I'm looking into going to school for neuropsychology. and possibly certified addiction counselor. And I'm also really big into physical fitness. So I'd like to get my certification to be a personal trainer as well.
That sounds awesome, man. And I was going to say, I think you have so much to offer, especially veterans, you know, and it's no secret that a lot of people suffer from PTSD that served in the military, so on and so forth. And I think, dude, you keep on the same track that you're on today and you're going to be there. I mean, you're an asset to the community here. You know, you're a joy to have around. The progress that you've made from the first time I met you till now has been astounding. And so I just want to tell you, you know, you're doing awesome. And I wish and I hope that obviously I can watch you grow through this process and help so many other people. Before we close, do you have anything that you would say, words of encouragement to people that are out there struggling, what to do, how to reach out, you know, anything like that?
It's a hard process, but until we get out of our comfort zone, we don't grow. You know, we have to set the fear aside and really walk through this thing and with courage. And there's always people to reach out to. You just have to take the initiative to do so. You know, the VA has a great program for veterans, and you know, it's unfortunate, but I think only 30% of addicts ever make it to treatment. So I would just say take that first step, and, you know, our thoughts become our reality. So believe in yourself. First and foremost, believe you can do it.
I think that's great advice. All right, that is it for this episode of Real Recovery Talk. Jeremy, again, thank you for coming on to the show. And don't forget to go to realrecoverytalk.com. There you will find every single episode. This is episode 156. Looking forward to getting this released. And that is it. We will see y'all later.
You've been listening to Real Recovery Talk with Tom Conrad. If you'd like to have a confidential conversation about your specific situation, give Tom a call on his direct line at 561-220-7163. Or if you'd prefer, you can chat with Tom live at realrecoverytalk.com. As always, if this show is a benefit to you, please give it a 5-star rating and review in Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, or wherever you discover your favorite podcasts. Thank you for being part of our mission to bring hope and healing to our loved ones struggling with addiction, as well as wisdom and comfort to those of us around them.